This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Judy Rebick supports Rabble because
Rabble's one of the very few spaces anywhere that you get a variety of views. All the new movements that emerged in Canada, whether it was Idle No More, the Maple Spring, the first place they appear is on Rabble.
Thanks, Judy. Just a few reasons to support Rabble.ca. Go to www.rabble.ca/donate.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Boko Haram rose to prominence last year when they kidnapped 276 girls from a government school in northern Nigeria. The group has only grown stronger and bolder since that attack. In recent weeks, at least 8 schools have been firebombed, and Nigeria's army has so far proven incapable of stopping them. Boko Haram now controls substantial portions of the northeast, and it has even made forays into Cameroon. The group may be aiming to create an Islamic State in the region. Where did Boko Haram come from and how have they become such a danger? Ajamu Baraka is an associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies and editor and contributing columnist for the Black Agenda Report. He has joined us by phone to discuss Boko Haram. Hello, Ajamu.
Hello, it's my pleasure to be with you.
Yes, it's our pleasure to have you. Listening to news reports and reading articles, it's as if Boko Haram sprung from the ground. There has not been a lot of discussion of the background of the group. Can you contextualize Boko Haram's emergence for us?
Yes, that's a very important question because it does appear for many that Boko Haram just came out of nowhere, but that really wasn't the case. Boko Haram is a organization, now an Islamic terrorist group, but it started off as an organization, primarily a religious organization in northeastern Nigeria in 2002. The leadership at that time was more concerned with advancing an Islamic agenda. They were very much connected to the politics of northern Nigeria. Many people might know that northern Nigeria is the location for most of the Muslims in that country. But they were they had a militant brand of Islam, and increasingly they found themselves in conflict with some of the elites that they were aligned with in northern Nigeria, and then increasingly with the Nigerian government. There were a series of some relatively minor clashes between Boko Haram and the Nigerian authorities. But many people argue that it wasn't until 2009 when there was a massive assault by the Nigerian authorities against Boko Haram that ended up with hundreds of their members and individuals who were associated with them, or it was claimed that they were associated with Boko Haram, were murdered by the Nigerian military, and even the leader, Mohammed Yusuf, was captured and then subsequently was murdered in very suspicious circumstances. We see that after that point, there was an increase, intensification of conflict between Boko Haram and the Nigerian authorities. They became more associated with the more radical Islamic Wahhabism of the of Al-Qaeda. But we see that they became even more lethal. They increased their military capacity even more so as a consequence of one very important event in Africa, and that was the attack and the overthrow of the government of Libya. As a consequence of that event, we see that a number of Islamic organizations associated with Al-Qaeda increased their military capacity because of the arms that were dumped into the open market, because of, some people argue, some of the alliances that were created in the attack on Libya with Islamic militants by the U.S. And France and the U.K. That then ended up indirectly or maybe directly enhancing the military capacities of the Islamic movement across North Africa. We find that the spillover effect was that Boko Haram ended up with militants being trained in Mali, arms that were clearly traceable to Libya ended up in their hands. And we see that after that period of time, there was an increased capacity on the part of that organization, and the Nigerian authorities have been paying a very steep price as a consequence of that.
So if I'm reading you correctly, two key events then played a role in the rise of the Boko Haram. One, internal, the government repression in 2009, and then the other one, external, the intervention in Libya.
Exactly.
Looking internally at Nigeria, oil is a big industry there. Is there any relationship between this industry and the rise of Boko Haram?
Only in the sense that the northern part of the country, and in particular the northeastern part of the country where Boko Haram has its main military and political presence, was an area of the country that's been relatively neglected by the central government. The results of the oil industry has not been manifest in that part of the country. So there are the conditions there that feed into the messages of Boko Haram that says basically that the Christians that run the country have no concern about Muslims. They allow for Muslims to live in poverty. They're neglected. They are corrupt. And that message has resonated with a number of young people, both rural and urban. In a way, the oil industry does play a role. There's another connection, though. One of the things that happened with the Bring Back Our Girls campaign was that the Nigerian authorities had been very reluctant to allow the U.S. military to be more closely aligned with the Nigerian military. We have to remember that we're talking about a country in which the military has taken power on a number of occasions. And so with the increase in Boko Haram's military capacities, there were offers from the U.S. to come in and to assist, but the Nigerian authorities resisted. But as a consequence of the Bring Back Our Girls campaign, the pressure was overwhelming, and they had decided to allow the U.S. Into the country. And many people argue, and I argue, that the real interest for the U.S. wasn't so much bringing back our girls, if you will, but that they wanted to, in fact, solidify a closer relationship to the Nigerian authorities. They are concerned about another insurgency that's in the southern part of the country that's threatening oil supplies in the south and off the coast, because that's where the main oil resources are located, and people need to be reminded that the U.S. is a major exporter of Nigerian oil. So this conflict gave the U.S. an entry point, if you will, into a deeper relationship with the Nigerian military as a consequence of this Boko Haram activity.
Well, turning back for a second to what you just mentioned about the U.S. wanting to have the Boko Haram designated a terrorist organization, why was Nigeria reluctant to go along with that?
Well, because it meant that they would have political pressure on them to allow for an international response, which really translates into a response from the U.S. State, allowing more of a role of the African Command or AFRICOM, and they were reluctant to do that because of the internal political situation. And that is, most of the officer corps in the Nigerian military are located in the north. Jonathan Goodluck and his administration are not that comfortable. In fact, some people argue that they are, in fact, intimidated by the military. And so there's been an effort to keep the military relatively weak. So any external any external influence that could result in a strengthened military was something that wasn't perceived to be in the interest of the current administration in Nigeria.
Well, we've looked at the U.S. response to Boko Haram. Turning to the international response overall, do you see any attempt by nations outside Africa to come to grips with why Boko Haram has been able to appeal to a large number of people in Nigeria?
I think that I don't think that they are attempting to come to grips with the why in terms of some of the socioeconomic contradictions. I think what we're seeing is a growing sort of regional cooperation among various states, principally Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. And the objective there is to deal with the Boko Haram threat militarily. They're not asking themselves the questions in terms of why is it that Boko Haram seems to continue to grow in strength. You know, it's framed in the West that these are just sort of some crazy folks who came out of nowhere who rule by terror. And that's, you know, the terror part is, in fact, a factor and it's real. But at the same time, you know, when you look closer, you see that there's a social base. There seems to be some support among various parts of the population. And there seems to be support even in places like Cameroon, where for many years served as the sort of the fallback point for Boko Haram that was operating in Nigeria. So the kind of socioeconomic conditions that we described in northeastern Nigeria also exist in Niger and Chad and in Cameroon. And in that sense, and because of the Islamic influences, these states have a real problem on their hands that just can't be addressed in a military fashion.
And now, to add to all of this, Nigeria is in the midst of a presidential election. How do you see that election playing out?
Well, it's a very interesting situation. The election is going to take place next month. It's clear that one of the objectives of Boko Haram was to ensure that various states, various Nigerian states in the Northeast would not be a part of that process. And I think that they are going to be successful in that. The Nigerian Electoral Commission has already said that if the Nigerian authorities cannot provide security to the election workers, then they're not going to subject their people to those kind of security concerns. And therefore, it appears that for a number of states, at least three of them, that there's not going to be any real participation on the part of the people in the upcoming elections. The other element that we're watching is the fact that both of the candidates, of course, Goodluck Jonathan, and the main challenger, Mohamed Madu Bukari, both are suggesting a military response to Boko Haram, I'm predicting though that if Bukari wins, that there will be some military activity, but I suspect that there may be some kind of political compromise because he has a base in the north. He has influence in the northern part of the country, and he's a northerner, of course, with a lot of influence in the military. So there may be a better chance of some kind of accommodation taking place with Boko Haram under a Bukari administration versus Goodluck Jonathan. But that's still a speculation. It seems that, like ISIS, Boko Haram now has its own agenda, and it appears that its main objective now is, in fact, to carve out this caliphate. I mean, right now they are in control of about 52,000 square kilometers, and this is cross-border territory also. So I suspect that it's going to be very difficult to narrow their focus again back to just what's happening in Nigeria.
And if it is a military solution that they attempt, do you see the United States being involved in that?
Well, the U.S. is very much involved already as a consequence of the decision to allow them to come into the country. They are involved in overflights in Nigeria to territory. They were training some of the Nigerian military units. They train the Cameroonian Rapid Deployment Battalion. So they are very much involved in the region and will probably be even more visible as we go forward, especially if the plan is to just try to confront Boko Haram militarily.
Well, thank you, Ajemu, for taking the time today to discuss this with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Ajemu Baraka. He is an associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies and editor and contributing columnist for the Black Agenda Report.